From The Conversation, this is Politics with Michelle Grattan, a podcast where we hear from politicians and experts on the issues of the day.
Scott Morrison has doubled down on his decision to stand by Attorney General Christian Porter, saying he's an innocent man under our law. The Prime Minister has also flatly ruled out seeking advice from the Solicitor General on whether Christian Porter is a fit and proper person to hold his portfolio as Attorney General, the first law officer of the Crown. Porter has denied the historical rape allegation levelled against him and is so far, at least, determined to stay in his job. He claims his resignation would create a precedent where anyone could lose their job based on, as he puts it, nothing more than an accusation that appears in print. He has stated his resignation would indeed render the job of Attorney General obsolete, as there would be no rule of law left to protect this country. To discuss the role of the Attorney General and the rule of law, this week Fleur Johns joins the podcast. She is a Professor of Law at the University of New South Wales and Australian Research Council Future Fellow at the University. A graduate of Harvard Law School and a Fellow of the Academy of the Social Sciences in Australia, Fleur Johns has a focus on international law and legal theory. Fleur Johns, the Attorney General is determined to return to his job, but without an inquiry, these allegations will dog him. How could this affect his work as Attorney General in the execution of duties as First Law Officer?
Well, Michelle, we can't really speculate about what might transpire in the course of Attorney General Porter's career personally, but in general terms, anyone in the role of Attorney General is responsible for representing the federal government in legal proceedings and providing legal advice to the government and really overseeing all aspects of the legal process and the workings of federal courts and tribunals, including the criminal justice system. The powers exercised by the Director of Public Prosecutions, for example, are delegated from the Attorney General to the DPP. So they sit at the pinnacle of all these institutions of justice. And so in addition to the professional responsibilities that all lawyers are held to their clients and to the administration of justice, a person in this role is really held to an even higher standard because they must be the custodian of the public trust in all these institutions and processes. So the public, which is the client that one needs to keep in mind for purposes of the Attorney General, needs to have confidence that the person in this role will exercise power fairly and responsibly in all circumstances and without any actual or, importantly, any perceived conflict of interest. So allegations that are made of a serious abuse of power having been conducted could erode that public trust, especially when those allegations have not had an opportunity to be tested, as is the case here. So it could, in general terms, raise questions, legitimate questions, about the capacity of a person to retain that public trust and to discharge all those responsibilities without the public having a perception of them being conflicted in doing so.
Could it raise in any circumstances legal questions? Could any sort of decisions be open to challenge?
I think it's difficult to envisage a specific circumstances where, say, a court ruling or a decision of the DPP or a piece of legislation where their validity or soundness would be called into question by these kinds of questions. It really is a more systemic and overarching question. It's a combination of ethics, professional ethics, and legal and political questions really bound up in this, in the importance of maintaining and defending the integrity of this role, which involves ensuring that anyone who occupies it can be seen and is seen as a person of the highest integrity that deserves the public's trust. But I can't envisage a situation where it would have the kind of specific impacts that you seem to be envisaging.
So the government has relied on the defence of the rule of law to justify not doing anything more about Christian Porter. You've described the rule of law as, and I quote, notoriously unclear and controversial, unquote. Could you try to define it for us and just canvass the problems as you see them in relying on it?
Yes. So my colleague Martin Krieger and I have written about this recently. It's really an umbrella term for a set of rules and mechanisms, all of which are aimed at preventing power from being exercised arbitrarily or tyrannically to the greatest extent possible. So it's all that is bound up in maintaining what we understand to be a system of being governed by laws rather than being governed by particular men or women who happen to possess power at any one time. So there's lots of principles that are then embedded in that umbrella term, including equality before the law, the idea that laws should apply equally to all people, the separation of powers between the executive, the legislature and the judiciary, and the independence of the judiciary, access to information about what the law is and about any decision that's taken by a government body against you, and a right to be heard about any such decision where it affects you significantly, and the right not to be punished by a public authority in the absence of a legal rule providing for that punishment. All these principles, which have all sorts of flow-on effects, are expressions of this ideal and this umbrella term, the rule of law. And so it is controversial because, of course, we can have lots of arguments about what it should mean in any one instance, but it is also in an as an ideal really quite robust and one, I think, very precious ideal that all sorts of people work to defend in their daily work through adhering to procedural rules that require, you know, disclosure of documents or require people to have a right to review in certain circumstances. All these kinds of, all the work that people do to ensure that people have these kinds of, experience this kind of fairness is all work in defence of the rule of law.
Now, Scott Morrison and others say that if you set up an independent inquiry to look at the allegation against Christian Porter, that would be, in fact, compromising the rule of law. You reject that view?
Yes, yes, wholeheartedly. I actually think an independent inquiry or investigation would actually serve the rule of law. Because what people who are arguing for an independent investigation are saying is not this is some entirely special process that's just designed for the Attorney General. It's really the kind of investigation or inquiry to which all sorts of other professionals and working people are subject routinely, day to day, week by week, year by year. So it's absolutely par for the course that the rule of law is delivered through a range of different procedural mechanisms. Of course, when we're talking about allegations of criminal behaviour, the primary mechanism and one that the public thinks of first is, of course, the police and the Director of Public Prosecutions and in certain circumstances, the criminal courts. But allegations that could potentially found criminal liability are also dealt with in all sorts of other ways. You know, professional standards boards, lawyers and medical practitioners are held to account before these kinds of bodies all the time and answer for allegations that could, in other circumstances, potentially give rise to criminal liability. Ombudsperson inquiries sometimes investigate a behaviour or alleged wrongdoing that could, in certain circumstances, give rise to criminal liability. We mentioned in our writing on this various conciliation mechanisms such as that of the Australian Human Rights Commission. There's just many, many mechanisms. And, of course, the civil proceedings, when someone is sued before us in a civil proceeding, those proceedings sometimes handle allegations that could, if they've been brought before a criminal court or through a criminal process, potentially give rise to legal liability of a criminal kind. So it's not as though we have one track for dealing with these kinds of allegations, and that's the only one that can deliver the rule of law. We have all these mechanisms, and each of these mechanisms has embedded in it rules and procedures that are designed to ensure defence and promotion of the rule of law, designed to ensure that the person who's facing the complaint or allegation has an opportunity to hear and receive the information about it and an opportunity to put their case in response, and in certain circumstances, rights to legal representation and so forth. So all these other mechanisms also have rule of law protections built into them. So whereas, as I explained earlier on, untested allegations floating around raise questions about integrity and capacity to retain the public trust, the testing of these allegations or the an inquiry around these allegations that could be convened in this setting with the appropriate protections to ensure the rule of law would actually be a way of ensuring that that ideal of the rule of law is defended and promoted, that we do experience a sense of being governed by laws and legal processes and legal institutions rather than by particular men or women who happen to be in power at any one time.
Well, if there was an inquiry in this particular instance, how would that look? It would presumably have to be done by a retired judge, and would it be desirably all private, and would that satisfy critics?
Well, it would have to be an independent inquiry conducted by someone who had that public confidence and was clearly impartial and competent to discharge the terms of reference. And the purpose of any such inquiry would not be to conduct something like a proxy for a criminal proceeding. What the purpose of that inquiry would be to determine whether the person occupying the role of Attorney General remains a fit and proper person and can be an appropriate custodian of the public trust going forward. So that would be the focus, I would imagine, of any such independent inquiry. And as I mentioned, professional standards bodies, licensing hearings do this all the time, asking, is X person a fit and proper person to hold the responsibilities or possess the rights that are being vested in them? We have a really good example in the recently announced action by the New York Attorney General, Letitia James, who announced that she's appointing two eminent lawyers. In this instance, they happen to be people who are working in private practice, so not retired judges, but one could imagine a retired judge would be an appropriate person to perform this role as well. And she's asked these two people to conduct an independent and thorough investigation of the facts surrounding the allegations of sexual harassment levelled against New York Governor Andrew Cuomo. So we couldn't design on the fly the terms of reference, but that's roughly speaking what it would look like. It would have to be independent. It would be focused really on this question of the responsibilities and demands on the role of Attorney General and the importance of affirming public confidence in that institution. And it would be need to be conducted under a terms of reference that were made public and that clearly included aspects that would be protective of the rule of law, including the rights of the person who was facing the allegations in question.
If we're talking about looking at whether someone's a fit and proper person, that seems to go well beyond a specific allegation of what he might have done in this particular situation in 1988, doesn't it? And wouldn't you get into the problem of not being able to make a determination about whether he was innocent or guilty of that allegation relating to 1988 because the woman is now deceased? And then you're looking at a whole lot of wider things he might have said and done in the past to deal with the fit and proper person issue.
Yes, well, again, the terms of reference would need to be nutted out very thoughtfully and carefully, but it wouldn't be, the terms of reference wouldn't direct any such independent inquiry to decide guilt or innocence for the reasons that you identified, and because this wouldn't be an appropriate forum to decide that question according to the relevant standard of proof. But the terms of reference could direct the relevant persons as to the scope of the investigation and also the kinds of questions that they were oriented towards, which I imagine would be about capacity to discharge current responsibilities and future responsibilities of the role of Attorney General, and capacity to publicly maintain an appearance of not having any conflict of interest and otherwise being a person of the highest integrity. So that the scope of the inquiry could be delimited by the terms of reference, and any looking back at prior allegations concerning an abuse of power would have to be connected to the question of whether a person in this role can currently continue to discharge that role with those, knowing what is known about those allegations. So they wouldn't be, you're right, they wouldn't be able to decide guilt or innocence. They wouldn't be able to test the allegations in the way that one would in a criminal court, but they could still address the question of what can be known about these allegations and any subsequent behaviour in relation to those allegations, and what bearing that information has upon the capacity of the Attorney General to maintain the public trust and continue to discharge the responsibilities of the role going forward.
Two other inquiries have been drawn into this debate. One is the investigation by police of the allegation against Bill Shorten of historical rape, and the police decided that they would take no further action after that investigation. The other is, of course, the Dyson Heydon case, where there was an investigation ordered by the High Court into allegations of sexual harassment. What parallels and differences do you see with these cases compared with the Porter issue?
Well, in relation to the first comparator, if the allegations against the Attorney General had been the subject of a 10-month investigation and the complainant, the alleged victim, was available, as I understand was the case in relation to the allegations against Bill Shorten, then I doubt very much that you would have this widespread public calling for a further inquiry into these questions of fitness and propriety. I think that would be the kind of process, working through of criminal process, that would be sufficient ordinarily to maintain public confidence in someone occupying the role of Attorney General. Here, through tragic circumstances beyond anyone's control, that possibility is foreclosed. It's practically, the system is practically inoperative. And so in order to maintain public confidence in this most venerable institution, the role of the Attorney General, the Office of the Attorney General, we need to look elsewhere within the legal system, look elsewhere in the legal toolbox to find a mechanism that will do so in a way that is respectful of the rights of the accused person and otherwise promotes this ideal of the rule of law. So it's not a direct comparator because we can't do what was done then in this instance for reasons that are beyond anyone's control. In terms of the investigation conducted by Dr. Vivian Tom, into the allegations of sexual harassment and inappropriate conduct by former High Court Judge Dyson Heydon. I think it's a useful comparator, Obviously, there are significant differences, both in terms of the nature of the allegations and also the nature of the investigation that was conducted. I haven't seen the terms of reference, but I imagine that that was oriented around both ensuring that the High Court was a safe place to work and also defending the integrity, public integrity of the institution. But it's a useful comparator in that we see that in that instance, there was a process, the police investigation was, there were complaints made that could have been investigated and were investigated and may still be being investigated by the police and taken through that route. But even in the presence of that, the Chief Justice of the High Court felt that the importance of maintaining public integrity in the institution of the High Court was so of such paramount importance that this additional process was had added value. And so because of the particular role of the Attorney General and the way that I've described it earlier, I think it's a useful comparator because some of the same issues arise here. Unlike any other minister or opposition leader, the Attorney General does have these particular responsibilities, and so it is appropriate, I think, in that instance, to think not just as we would think about any other professional, but also about the importance of maintaining the integrity of the institution. And Dr. Tom's investigation was conducted in ways that I understand were called into question by counsel for Justice Hayden, but nonetheless were not widely seen as a kind of kangaroo court or punitive or highly questionable. I think they were it was widely applauded as a mechanism to ensure both the safety of the workplace and the integrity of the institution of the High Court.
Just finally, how important is the course of this affair now for the Office of Attorney General, for the legal system more generally?
I think it's immensely important in a number of ways. As I've explained, the Attorney General has these actual powers, but the office is also a repository of great symbolic power. It's really representative of this idea that public power should not be unrestrained, that it should be tempered by constraints and by officials who are charged with standing apart from their own self-interest and ensuring fairness and the administration of justice in the fullest sense of the term. So I think it's an important consideration in this instance that symbolic power, that symbolic value, has been called into question by very serious allegations that go to the ability of a person to exercise power over another person in a way that is responsible and not abusive. I also think it's important because the legal profession has, as you know, been a site of really very widespread systemic problems of underrepresentation of women and people of colour and minorities. And so many law firms have this problem of ensuring that their uppermost ranks are representative and reflect the lawyers that are being trained in our universities and that there are equal opportunities for all people who enter the legal profession. So there's long been a well-recognised problem, including problems faced by women in rising through the legal profession, especially to its highest levels, in private practice, in the bar, and to some extent in government, although government I think has done much better in many instances than private practice or the bar. So because of that, those particular problems associated with the legal system and our industry of legal practice, I think this is a key moment when women and those who care about questions of equality and equal opportunity are really are really looking for an indication that business as usual is not continuing, that the questions that have been raised by a wide range of people in recent weeks are going to be heard, and that there's a commitment to doing things differently going forward. And so I really hope that this is a moment when we can rise to that challenge and that opportunity and do something that clearly says to the women and women lawyers of Australia that any kind of abuse of power, obviously this is one of the most, the allegations concern the most serious kind of gendered violence, but any kind of gendered abuse of power or gendered violence is unacceptable, and that that is, stamping that out is not just a kind of special interest of certain people, but it's fundamental to the maintenance and good practice of our institutions of government, and indeed fundamental to the rule, upholding the rule of law. So for those two reasons, because of this additional symbolic value and the particular moment and opportunity to attend to historic and ongoing practices of gendered violence and gendered inequality, I think this is a particularly significant question before the government surrounding what to do about these untested allegations against the Attorney General.
Well, clearly it's an issue I think that has a long way to run and, as you've indicated, in all sorts of directions. Fleur Johns, thank you very much for talking with the Conversations Politics podcast today. That's all from us for now. Thank you to my producer, Tom Glassie. We'll be back with another interview soon, but for now, goodbye.
Our theme music is by Lee Rosevier. You can find more podcasts from The Conversation on our website at theconversation.com.